Happy Monday afternoon, everybody. Welcome inside our studios here in Northern Nevada. Hope everybody had a nice, safe weekend. Hope if you are a sports fan that you were enjoying, which I imagine you would be if you're listening to ESPN Radio. Hope you enjoyed what felt like kind of the first normal weekend that we've had in a few months. We had a UFC event on. We had NASCAR on. There was golf on. There was soccer on. I mean, there was some live sports happening that even without fans, just the ability to kind of switch back and forth between some different events, live events, just felt really really good. So hopefully you got to enjoy some of that. We're going to talk about that today. We'll talk about UFC Fight Night coming up here, as well as some of the soccer and golf that was on this weekend. We'll talk about the NASCAR race coming up in the next segment, as well as a very interesting mishap over in the Korean Soccer League. We'll talk about that. Then, obviously, a lot of interest and a lot of kind of questions around how Cam Newton doesn't have a team yet. Well, it turns out that he was close to possibly having a team a little while back. So we'll talk about that. And then, of course, I'll give you my reaction to Episode 9 of The Last Dance. Obviously, 9 and 10 aired last night. But there's just so much that goes on in these episodes. I'm going to talk about episode 9 today. We'll save for episode 10 for tomorrow. And then, of course, end the day looking at some events that happened on this day in sports history. But first, let's get to it. Let's talk about some of the stuff that went on this weekend. First, of course, was the UFC fight on Saturday night. It was the third and final event that UFC has put on in this 8-day period. Of course, it started with UFC 249, a week ago from last Saturday. And then we had the midweek fight card. Now we had Overeem versus Harris on Saturday night. And an interesting card for a few reasons, really. I mean, the preliminary card was a really fun card to watch. Courtney Casey had a really standout appearance there in the women's flyweight fight on the preliminary card, when she got a first-round submission via armbar over Mara Romero Borrelia. So a very impressive showing there from Courtney Casey. Also from Miguel Beza, who was in the preliminary card main event and took on a very veteran fighter in the UFC, and Matt Brown, who was able to finish him with a second-round TKO just 18 seconds in. So some very attention-grabbing performances there. And one of the most attention-grabbing performances of that preliminary card might as well have been Kevin Holland, who got a 39-second TKO victory over Anthony Hernandez. Just two first-round finishes on the card. Courtney Casey was the first one, and then Kevin Holland with the TKO there just 39 seconds in. And anytime you can get a first round finish, that's always grabs the attention of a lot of fans and analysts that watch this sport. But to do it in under a minute, those are the type of special nights you have in fighting, whether it's MMA or boxing. Anytime you can get a finish within the first minute of a fight, I mean, that's saying something right there. So some big statements made by some fighters on the preliminary card, which were very entertaining to watch. Then we got to the main card, and the main card was an entertainingly frustrating card because it had a lot of really good fights and a lot of really fun fights, but it just seemed like the judges just couldn't get it right. And it's hard to be mad at them because of how close a lot of these fights were. I mean, the two split decision fights that were the featherweight fight between Dan Inge and Edson Barboza, and the co-main event in the women's strawweight division between Claudia Gandahl and Angela Hill, were both extremely close. And I thought that Edson Barboza and Angela Hill both won those. They were split decision losses for the two fighters, but those were the ones that I thought were missed the most. The other one I thought could have gone the other way was Marlon Vera over Sung Yadong. But for the most part, I think Yadong really kind of held his own in that fight. And you could make the argument that he did do enough to win. I still think personally Marlon Vera won that fight, but I could see how that one could go either way. The Eric Anders and Jotkov fight that came after the Yadong and Vera fight, I think, was correctly called by the judges there. I think Eric Anders did have a really solid fight and did do enough. Again, you could say to justify winning that fight on the judges' scorecard. But I think that was the one I did agree with the most. But the other three decisions there on the main card just really made you scratch your head. I mean, you just don't know. I mean, the old adage, and I've said it a lot of times on this show, that you just don't know what fight the judges are watching. And it really felt that way on the main card. I mean, the two decisions that they had in the preliminary card, you know, I can get behind. I think they got those two fights right. But you get to the main card, and it was really just kind of questionable decision after questionable decision from the judges. But when you have so many fights that are that competitive and that close, it's hard to be mad at the judges for every one. So to me, the most egregious miss was probably Angela Hill over Claudia Goodall. I mean, I think Claudia did, had a really solid fight. I think that you obviously can make an argument that she did enough to win it, but I think Angela Hill was more the aggressor. I think she was able to do a little more damage, and I think that she, even if it was a split decision the other way, I think Angela Hill was the biggest miss by the judges on that night. But then we get to the main event, and the main event with all of its emotion and all of its attention, obviously Walt Harris, it was well documented what he was going through coming into this fight, having his stepdaughter murdered, you know, while he was still preparing for this fight last year. And it's not easy. And I think, you know, it's not easy being an MMA fighter, period, or really a combat athlete, period. But when you follow that up with tragedy in your family and such a personal tragedy like that, it would have been totally understandable for him to pull out of that fight and just say that he wasn't going to do it and wasn't going to take part in it. But he showed up. He showed up, he fought his rear end off. I mean, I thought it was over in the first round. When he landed a couple of solid shots, got over him on the ground, just started landing heavy, heavy shots on top, I thought that was it. And you have to wonder if all that emotion started to come out. I mean, he had suffered the loss of his stepdaughter. He kept training through it. He kept himself kind of in that mindset of getting ready for his fight. And when he finally get there, and you finally start to land some blows and finally start to, you know, just kind of let some of that emotion out. I wonder if it was just so emotional at the beginning of that fight. That's what kind of led to him being able to get the upper hand over him. And I think during that melee where he was just landing shots on Alistair Overeem, it settled into Walt Harris that the fight wasn't going to end during that barrage. So you could see him kind of take a step back and slow the pace down a little bit to not tire himself out. But I think once Overeem recovered from that, the overall emotion of the situation just kind of got to Walt Harris. And he still fought an amazing fight throughout the 8 minutes or so he had actual fighting going on. But you know, hats off to Alistair Overeem. He saw his opportunity, and he finished it with a second-round TKO. You feel for Walt Harris. I mean, you really do. And I mean, hats off to both men. And there was a very, you know, a lot of sportsmanship between the two of them before and after the fight. Alistair Overeem, you know, really comforting Walt Harris, going right over to him after the fight stopped. They embraced again after the official decision was announced by Bruce Buffer. So a lot of good sportsmanship, and you love to see that. And just really got to take your hat off again to Walt Harris for showing up and proving that, you know, if you have a drive and you have a goal and you have a focus, you can get through hard times, you can continue to move on, and you can continue to just work and continue to master your craft and regardless of what you do. So even though Walt Harris lost that fight, I think he's become a real champion among fans and among other fighters for staying committed to that fight and continuing his training and showing up. And again, he almost won. He almost got a finish in that fight, but Alistair Overeem just hung in there. And we've seen kind of this push from these older fighters right now. Over these three cards, over 8 days, a lot of old fighters have been, or older fighters, have been making some statements. Now Alistair Overeem's the next one to do it. So we'll see if this helps send him to maybe another title shot late in his career. But nonetheless, it was a really solid performance there from Overeem, a solid performance from Harris, and really a fun card to watch. I think the UFC did a fantastic job putting on these three fight cards in 8 days. The only real speed bump in the whole process was Jacare Zouza and his camp having to pull out of the UFC 249 because of their positive test for the coronavirus. But that was it. Just the one fighter in the one camp that ended up getting, a positive test. Otherwise, everybody else made it through the event. We had three, I shouldn't say we, the UFC had three really fun and entertaining cards that they were able to put on, even though in front of no fans. I think there was still a good amount of energy coming off the fighters, and I really enjoyed it. I really enjoyed the three fight cards. I'm looking forward now to the more cards they're going to put on. I'm still just extremely eager to see what Fight Island looks like, but nonetheless, got to take your cap off to the UFC for being able to put this on and conducting it really with just the one issue with Zouza and his camp there before UFC 249. So that is pretty gosh darn impressive. So hats off there to Dana White and the UFC. But the UFC, not the only thing on this weekend. German soccer returned. The Bundesliga getting back and going again. I've never been a huge fan of that. I don't really follow it, but, you know, I enjoy top-level soccer. I enjoy watching a few good teams going at it, and it was an interesting weekend. We had the rivalry, of course, between Dortmund and Schalke 04 that has, you know, just one of the bigger rivalries there in Germany, and Dortmund came away with a huge 4-0 win. In that rivalry, it's one of the bigger wins in their history there. So that was pretty incredible to see that. The team kind of chasing them down. Or the team that is leading Dortmund right now by 4 points, Bayern Munich, returned with a 2-0 win of their own to help keep them 4 points ahead of Dortmund there at the top of the table. And then another German team that was making some real headway this season and making a name, especially in the Champions League, was Red Bull Leipzig. And they came back against SC Freiburg and opened up with a 1-1 draw in their return to Bundesliga play. So it was still good to see that. It was good to see some soccer out there and live soccer and see how that's going. Obviously, Spain getting players still ready and training again. Premier League trying to figure it out. Major League Soccer trying to figure it out. But Germany back up and running again, and it was fun to see. Also fun to see some live golf that was going on over the weekend. There was a skins competition between the teams of Roy McIlroy and Dustin Johnson, taking on Ricky Fowler and Matthew Wolff. And, of course, it was conducted with that skeleton type of TV crew. So you had, you know, just the one or two TV commentators, the couple cameras that were following around, the golfers all with that 6 feet of social distancing. The golfers were 6 feet apart. And just fun to watch. Fun to watch them go back and forth. Obviously, skins game, there was some money on the line that was going to be donated after the match. So, and it was it ended up being a good match. It looked as though, at first, Fowler and Wolff were going to run away with it, winning the first 6 skins throughout the game. And then, as McIlroy and Johnson started to make a comeback, they had a chance to win the last 6 holes and possibly win the match between the two teams. But both McIlroy and Johnson missed opportunities to win on the 18th hole. So they had to go to a closest shot to the pin contest back on the par 3 17th to decide it all. And you had Fowler and Johnson completely miss the green, and, you know, in total. You had Fowler land in, I think, just the rough behind the putting green. Then you had Johnson land in the sand trap. Luckily, Matthew Wolff did get his shot on the green. It was about 18 or so feet away from the hole. But Roy McIlroy got his shot 13 feet away from the hole. So McIlroy and Dustin Johnson were the winners of the skins game. McIlroy and Johnson donated $1.85 million to the American Nurses Foundation. And Fowler and Wolff donated $1.15 million to the CDC Foundation. So good to see some live golf. Good to see some money being raised for some COVID relief efforts there. And all in all, just a fun weekend again. Just an interesting weekend to have some live sports on. You can kind of flip back and forth between and just kind of soak in and enjoy. And that did not stop with the UFC and soccer and golf, because NASCAR was also back this weekend. So we'll talk about that. And then an interesting mishap with the Korean Soccer League. So we'll talk about that coming up next on the Spencer Wilson Show on ESPN Radio 94.5 FM.
Is your technology infrastructure meeting the demands of your customers, your employees, you? How does your network scale to support your growth plans? With distribution hiding behind every corner, it's time you benefited from a network and security provider that will guide your organization through rapid technology change. Blackfoot, here to enable what's next. Visit blackfoot.com/SDWAN to learn more.
Well, one thing we are all very aware of and that we are just kind of accepting as time goes by as sports fans is that when sports returns, There's not going to be anybody in the stands, right? We saw that with NASCAR over the weekend. We've seen it with the three UFC events. That's something we understand. And if you've watched any of the KBO, the Korean Baseball League over there, which ESPN has been broadcasting some of those games in that league, you'll notice that they use kind of cutouts. They'll put cardboard cutouts or photos of people kind of on the seats just to kind of give it the look to have that, you know, you have kind of fans there, even though there's no reaction from them, obviously, since they're not real. It still does kind of the look of having people in the stands, which I'm not totally against. I mean, if that brings some kind of comfort to players or just to a viewing audience to have some kind of resemblance of people there, you know, I mean, I'm not creeped out or anything by it. But however, FC Seoul, who is one of the more recognizable soccer teams over in the K-League there, tried to do something similar, yet something was kind of lost in translation. Because FC Seoul ended up using, inadvertently using sex dolls to act as fans. Which is interesting, because apparently the CEO of a company called Dollcom, is a fan of FC Seoul. So he donated some dolls that he apparently assured people were not for adult pleasure and gave them to FC Seoul so they could put them in the stands to act as fans. They would have, you know, if they had masks on, and they would hold up some signs, whether it was, you know, a supportive sign for the team or something like stay healthy or anything like that. But as the, and where they put these dolls as well in the stadium was behind one of the goals where, you know, kind of the more rabid fans would be during the game. So, of course, that section's getting shown a lot. And as that section started to get shown more and more on TV, as you can imagine, social media over in South Korea started going absolutely ballistic once they realized what they were looking at. So, K-League is obviously going to look into the incident, and it's a hefty fine that FC Seoul will be dealt if they are found guilty of this. And the fans got so outraged online that some went to say that FC Seoul had damaged the prestige of Korean football. So obviously this is not something being taken lightly by anybody over there. And the club, FC Seoul, went ahead and released a statement on their social media that reads, quote, "We would like to apologize to the fans. We are very sorry about the supporting mannequins that were placed during the game on May 17th. These mannequins have been made to look like real humans, but they are not for sexual use, as confirmed by the manufacturer from the beginning. Our intention was to do something lighthearted in these difficult times. We will think hard about what we need to do to ensure that something like this never happens again." End quote. And Dollcom's homepage, as of earlier today, was still offline in terms of being able to go there and access the site. So obviously this is not going over very smoothly in South Korea. And I mean, really, it's, I guess it's a mistake I can understand. I mean, if you go to somebody as the CEO of a corporation like this, you're taking some risks into your own hands. I mean, there are, no pun intended, but there are, I mean, you got to think, if you're going to somebody that manufactures these type of dolls and then you decide to go to, I mean, I don't care if he's a fan or not. You got to know that you're taking some kind of risks. And I didn't know how much, I mean, obviously, I don't know if this would be as big of a deal here in the United States. I mean, if a team got caught doing that, I imagine there would be some uptight parents somewhere that would send in a tweet or call in or something like, "I can't believe I had to explain to my kid what that was," or whatever they say. But I have a feeling that it wouldn't be as big of a deal here. But obviously, I'm not as used to South Korean customs and you know, what the culture is like around sports and all of that over in that country. So obviously, this is becoming a very big deal to them. And I don't know how big the fine is. It didn't say how big it would be, but I imagine if you ever use the words hefty fine, it would be at least five digits, maybe more. So, I mean, they'll look into it. And if it was a clear and you know, true inadvertent mistake by FC Seoul, where they were told that it wasn't, these dolls weren't for that purpose, and they ended up being for that purpose, and they didn't know, then so be it. But there's a part of me that thinks it's a little hilarious that sex dolls were put into stands acting as fans. I imagine they would look excited, you know? So that's something that could help you out there, add a little energy into the building. But nonetheless, it was an odd story to see that, because I started thinking, like, what if at a Lakers game or something, or at a Dodgers game or something like that, you know, they pan to one of the stands behind the bench or behind the dugout, and there were two or three sex dolls sitting there with masks on and signs that said, like, go L.A. or something like that. Would people be as mad about it? I don't think they'd be as mad. I think most fans would probably find it a little hilarious. Then again, different countries, different customs, different cultures. So we'll see if there's any kind of follow-up to this investigation, but not something I was expecting to hear about on Monday morning. But one, obviously, sport that didn't have to worry about fake fans in the stands and any kind of issue is that was NASCAR. As NASCAR made its return to the track this past weekend, yesterday actually, or on the track, for a race at Darlington. And Darlington is, I'm not, a diehard NASCAR fan. I don't know the history of it, and I don't know, all the different facts and stuff like that. But even I know how prestigious the track in Darlington is, that whether you want to call it the egg shape or the paperclip shape, whatever it might be, it's a fun track to watch. It's a very interesting track to see how races unfold. And especially with the heat that was going on during the day there in on the track there in Darlington, it made for kind of a slicker racetrack. So watching some cars, having to fight for grip every now and then made it a little interesting, especially Jimmy Johnson wrecking there at the end of stage one, going for that stage one win and pushing just a little too hard. Again, I think typically the Darlington races you see are kind of late afternoon into early evening type races, so it gets a little cooler there at night during the race. This time it was middle of the day on Sunday, so obviously the temperature was a little higher up, so they were dealing with that. And again, seeing someone like Jimmy Johnson, who even when he's pushing and pushing the limits of that car, you don't really expect him to slide out, especially, not that early on in the race, so just kind of tells you what the conditions were and how different it was. And maybe, a lot of these guys take part in virtual racing, and that's how they keep themselves sharp, especially during this break. A lot of more drivers got into that virtual atmosphere. But, to see someone like Jimmy Johnson kind of wreck and while pushing his car like that just kind of makes you wonder what kind of, or how much rust some of these guys were going through when they first arrived at Darlington and got to drive on that track and see how it feels. But nonetheless, I still thought it was a really entertaining race. Obviously, again, no fans there. It looked a little different, but this is what I've been kind of talking about. If there's one sport that I think can really survive like usual in these kind of no fan times what we're living in because of the coronavirus, it's auto racing. Because yes, the visual of not having the fans there was obviously really different, especially in a place like Darlington where they get a nice crowd every year. But for the most part, you hear and you see the cars during a race, and you get those moments of kind of quiet along the home stretch. You can hear some of those pops from the crowd, or any time that Dale Jr. used to make a move, you could hear the pop from the crowd. But for the most part, you listen to and watch the cars. So while it was different not to see any fans there in terms of watching the race, listening to the race, it was about as normal as you could get in terms of a sport. I mean, UFC, you really noticed the fans not being there. In golf, again, it's some of that visual of the fans there, because for the most part, they're relatively quiet during a golf round. But, when you get the big putts, a nice chip, you miss kind of those quick oohs and ahs and the claps there. But in terms of fan interaction, for auto racing, you're not really missing that. It's not like you really notice it, and now it's gone. So the visual was a little bit different, but in terms of being able to take the race in, it felt like any other NASCAR race, and it was awesome. Again, you kind of look for those little spots of normalcy right now. And this weekend really had that feel to it, and I really enjoyed watching that NASCAR race. And we saw William Byron go on to win stage one. As Jimmy was pushing and crashed, William Byron went on to win that stage. Brad Keselowski went on to win stage two of the race. And then Kevin Harvick gets his 50th win as they're at Darlington, winning the race. And he was followed by Alex Bowman in second, then Kurt Busch in third. And some other interesting contacts or some spin outs there during the race. Talked about Jimmy Johnson, but Kyle Busch at one point went up and scraped the wall, which ended up taking off parts of a banner from one of the sponsors, and that got kind of wrapped around, I think, two other cars throughout the race. So that was kind of a wild thing to see there with your eyes. But nonetheless, I thought it was a really fun race. Hats off to NASCAR for being able to come back. And I think for any racing, whether it's IndyCar, Formula One, Formula E, whoever, when you look at that, obviously we want fans there. But I think you see that. You see the drivers with the masks, how they take care of themselves pre and post race, how, you know, teams and drivers to be able to enjoy race weekend. I think it gives everybody a little bit of hope that when more racing returns throughout the different leagues across the not just here in the United States, but across the world, it's going to be, again, visually a little different, but we're still going to be able to enjoy the sights and sounds of a motor race, which I think is what we're all kind of looking forward right now, at least those in the auto racing community, whether you're more of an analyst or a reporter or just a fan. We're all just kind of waiting for more of those races to return in NASCAR. I think gave us a little bit of a fix for that, what we've been hankering for, and also kind of shows us that brighter days are coming up down the road. But really fun to watch that race this weekend. And they're going to be back on the track in Darlington for another Cup Series race this Wednesday. So I'm looking forward to that, to see how that goes as well. All right, we're going to take a break. When we come back, Cam Newton, still a free agent, although it seems as though there was one team that was considering signing him. We'll talk about that after the break here on the Spencer Wilson Show on ESPN Radio, 94.5 FM.
Is your technology infrastructure meeting the demands of your customers, your employees, you? How does your network scale to support your growth plans? With distribution hiding behind every corner, it's time you benefited from a network and security provider that will guide your organization through rapid technology change. Blackfoot, here to enable what's next. Visit blackfoot.com/SDWAN to learn more.
Cam Newton continues to be a free agent. Whether that is a surprise to you or not, that's a fact. He is still an unsigned free agent. And it's been interesting just to see how there doesn't seem to be any interest. There wasn't any interest when he first got released by Carolina. There wasn't any interest kind of right after the draft, when we saw teams that still needed some help at quarterback and teams that might look to have a kind of veteran presence, maybe a backup. I mean, there really hasn't been any discussion around a possible landing spot for Cam Newton. Now, there was some, you know, small talk before the draft that maybe the Chargers were looking at him. Maybe, you know, some other teams in the NFC had an idea. Maybe he'd go to Washington and reunite with Ron Rivera. There was some just small discussions around where Cam Newton could go. It turns out that head coach Anthony Lynn of the Chargers did say in a recent interview that the Chargers absolutely considered signing Newton, saying that he, quote, did take a look at that, end quote. And I talked about that here on the show before, that I wouldn't have been against a signing of Cam Newton to the Chargers. But as a team that was moving on from one veteran quarterback in Phillip Rivers, why not use this time now to look towards a younger guy that you can really set up for the next 10 to 12 years or so? Whether that is a Tyrod Taylor, or now whether we know it's a Justin Herbert. I mean, why not take this time to really groom your next star? A young quarterback that can really be brought in fresh to your system and just start to develop them towards the future. Now, you could have brought Cam Newton in and had a Herbert sit behind him for a year, but then you risk a guy that's been dealing with injuries and missed a chunk of the season last year. I think that's part of why he's not being signed. But I thought it was interesting, some of the other quotes that came from this conversation with head coach Anthony Lynn. Here's another quote where he was talking about kind of the quarterbacks they had already had before drafting Justin Herbert. So here was this comment. He says, quote, Tyrod Taylor, Easton Stick, those are guys that a lot of people don't talk about. Stick was a Division I AA star. He won like 3 national championships. He's a hell of a leader, hell of a professional. And I think he has a bright future in this league one day. But with him, Tyrod Taylor, and knowing that we had an opportunity to get one picking 6 in the draft, all those decisions came into play when talking about Cam, end quote. Which, again, is understandable. If you're in a position to where you could have a veteran quarterback on your squad, do you want to have to go through the issue of, you know, kind of controlling him and his emotion with if he comes in thinking that he has a chance to be your starting quarterback, which Cam Newton, I think, would have. Really, regardless of where he goes, you would have to give him some kind of thought of being a starter, what that could bring to your team. But I think that ultimately the right decision was made by Coach Anthony Lynn and the Chargers by not signing Cam Newton, because even though Easton Stick has no regular season experience with the Chargers, he was a part of that powerhouse North Dakota State football program up there in the FCS, and he's gotten some preseason time, and he's looked okay during that time, so you know, he's a good third-string quarterback to have. And Tyrod Taylor, of course, with his NFL experience, was somebody that you could rely on, but it really came down to that draft pick. Whether it was Tua or whether it was Herbert, obviously now we know it's Herbert. It was really going to come down to that. I think with some of the rumblings leading up to the draft of the Chargers maybe passing on a quarterback, if they had done that, if they had chosen to go with an offensive lineman or some other direction with that 6th pick in the first round, then I could really see them going for Cam Newton. But since they went ahead and drafted Herbert, I think that was them saying, we're committed to the new young guy of the future instead of a 31-year-old quarterback that missed 14 games last season because of a foot injury. And, of course, also dealing with a shoulder injury in recent years as well. So it's a tough boat for Cam Newton to be in, but this could still be a blessing in disguise for Cam Newton. Because let's say he continues down this road and he doesn't get signed and he stays a free agent. Take this year. Take this season and fully recover. Make sure your foot's back to full health. Maybe make sure your shoulder's back to full health. Make sure you mentally feel ready to go back into the NFL. I think regardless of whether he signed this year or maybe he does take the rest of this year and get signed before next season, his days as an automatic starter is over. The next time he signs with a team, it will be as a predetermined backup quarterback, or he'll show up and have to compete with no real guarantee that he'll win any kind of quarterback battle against whoever he might face. But I still think he can be a threat. I don't think he should run as much anymore. With this foot injury, being over 30 now, taking a lot of punishment in his 20s when he was in the NFL, I think he needs to worry about scrambling, not running. Because I think he still has some good power in his arm. That shoulder injury is going to be a problem, but I still think there's some good power and good accuracy in that arm. So because he's just a big, burly guy already, if you scramble and make, you know, I mean, I think he can outrun or outmuscle just about any defensive lineman. I think he stands a very good chance against almost any defensive lineman in the NFL. So if he can scramble and fight off those guys while giving your receivers and running backs a chance out in the field against whether it's one-on-one coverage or zone coverage and just give them time to make a play, I think Cam Newton can find a resurgence here in the second half of his career should he have one. I still think he will. I don't know if he's going to get signed before this season, but I think Cam Newton will find his way back to the NFL as a backup quarterback. But I think there's always a possibility that he could again see the field as a starter. And if he does, I hope that wherever he's playing doesn't ask him to try to be the runner that he once was. I think those days are gone. But I think there's still power in his arm. I think there's still accuracy in his arm. I think there is still strength in his lower body. It's just time to focus that strength on scrambling and then just having that base to throw off of instead of trying to run and put yourself in harm's way. I think, you know, running is now kind of for the QBs in their 20s. I think once you start to get into the 30s, especially if you're Cam Newton, have some foot and shoulder injuries, I think it's time to start really thinking about just being a scrambler or a pocket thrower, regardless of what you used to be. And that might be a really tough transition for Cam Newton, but I think it's a transition that could really help save the second half of his career wherever he goes. We still have to see if he'll even get signed, period. But I think it could be a blessing in disguise for him to not get signed heading into this season. Take this year, which we don't really know what it's going to look like, so maybe save yourself some stress there as well and just recover, just recoup. Get yourself physically, mentally, and emotionally ready to return to the NFL in the best shape you can be in without having to worry about, you know, coming off an injury and what might possibly happen to that. Are you coming back too soon? Anything like that. So I'm happy the Chargers, I mean, I do think it was smart for them to consider it, but I'm happy that they ultimately decided to pass on Cam Newton. I think this could still be a blessing in disguise for him should he not find a team before the start of the 2020-2021 season. But we'll just have to see how that all pans out. We're going to take a break. When we come back, the 10-part documentary series that gripped every sports fan and basketball fan in the country for the last 5 weeks came to an end last night. And I'm not going to cover both episodes, but I will give you my reaction to episode 9 coming up after the break here on the Spencer Wilson Show on ESPN Radio 94.5 FM.
Is your technology infrastructure meeting the demands of your customers, your employees, you? How does your network scale to support your growth plans? With distribution hiding behind every corner, it's time you benefited from a network and security provider that will guide your organization through rapid technology change. Blackfoot, here to enable what's next. Visit blackfoot.com/SDWAN to learn more.
Well, if you're like many people out there and you're wondering what you're going to do now with your Sundays that the Last Dance is done, fear not, because 30 for 30 keeps delivering some amazing documentaries, as we have the documentary Lance, which is all about Lance Armstrong, obviously, which has a two-part, which is being broken into two parts. Part one coming up this next Sunday, part two the Sunday after that. Then we have Be Water, which is that documentary about Bruce Lee, which I'm really looking forward to. And then after that, The Long Gone Summer, which documents the summer that Mark McGwire and Sammy Sosa lit it up on the baseball diamond. So don't be too worried, as the next four Sundays, we're still going to have some fantastic documentaries to watch in the world of sports. But The Last Dance is over. Just like the 97-98 Chicago Bulls season, everything does come to an end. And, I mean, I think we can all agree it was just an amazing series. I mean, it should win every single award it's nominated for, because it's going to be nominated for a truckload of awards, I would imagine. But I don't hate MJ, right? I mean, that's what we were all told, was we were all going to see this different side. We're all going to see this part of MJ that you're just not going to like, and you're not going to like him anymore. But after every single episode, and now with the series done, I like him even more. And I've said that a few times, but I think as a kid, I mean, when I was growing up, I was a baby during this final run of Michael Jordan and the Chicago Bulls. I mean, when they won their sixth championship in the summer of 98, I was 4 years old. So I never got to really enjoy that run as it was happening. But of course, growing up, starting to play rec ball and AAU basketball, as soon as you started to study the history of the game, the first name that would come up most times is Michael Jordan. So you obviously have a great understanding of who he is and what he meant. And then I did get to see the official end of his career after he was playing with Washington and retired for good after that from playing. But that was really the only time I got to see him in person. I got to sit down and watch those Wizards games when he was playing for Washington. But we've heard time and time again about his competitiveness, about this fire, and how it was unlike anybody else. And I think what a lot of people expected us to, or what was kind of the driving factor in people thinking that we would not like him after seeing this, was how much he called out his teammates, how much he would trash talk his own teammates, how, you know, he would look for the smallest things to motivate him a little bit more and kind of put him to that kind of a-hole level or whatever it might be. But knowing now and being more involved in the world of sports, knowing what it takes for athletes to get to a point where they can go out there and be as unstoppable as they possibly can in terms of sometimes leading their teams to a championship and not leading their teams to a championship, to see the way Michael Jordan would find ways to motivate himself. I mean, even the, I think it was episode 8, right, where they were talking about the 96 finals against the Seattle Supersonics. And Michael Jordan is in a restaurant. He sees Karl Malone, the Supersonics head coach at the time. And all Karl Malone did was walk out of the restaurant. He didn't look at MJ, he didn't say anything at MJ, but he just walked right by him. And that little instance, just that small event, led Michael Jordan to motivate himself through the rest of the 96 finals. And any time that he talked about how he would motivate himself, how he would find little things to pump him up and just get himself that much more on edge and that much more ready to go out there and dominate, just made me, you know, really kind of sit there in awe, even more awe of what this man accomplished and what he did. And really fun to see the way that Reggie Miller got under his skin, because if you have watched a lot of those 30 for 30s, then one that was released way, way back in volume one of these documentaries was a movie called Winning Time, the story of Reggie Miller versus the New York Knicks. And if you watched that like I did when it came out, you would have seen all the different ways that Reggie Miller got under the skin of those New York Knicks. So to see him then come back around and do the same thing to Michael Jordan, the Bulls, I don't know, it gave me this kind of just fuzzy feeling inside. I was kind of laughing my way through watching that and watching Reggie Miller talk about how he would get under Michael Jordan's skin. And again, no one apparently decided to pay attention to the message to not make MJ angry. Because again, another story comes out of how Reggie Miller, back when he was first starting to play with the Pacers, they were playing the Bulls, he had this great first half, and he makes this little comment to Michael Jordan, and then in the second half, MJ goes off and shuts him down completely. So apparently the message never really seemed to get it. It's always like those contenders that would go after, like Mike Tyson or somebody in the hell. Like anytime you see a great fighting champion and somebody, every other contender's like, oh, you haven't fought anybody like me. He hasn't seen my speed. They always have that one talking. They get to the fight and they just get dominated. It felt like that was the same way with all these different teams around Michael Jordan and the Bulls. Each team thought they were going to be the ones to knock them off. So then they got cocky and said something to Michael Jordan, probably most of the time just a sentence. And the next thing you know, MJ's tearing them apart. And it just never seemed to get through these people, not to make him angry. But it was awesome. It was awesome to see Reggie Miller and hear him talk about how he got under the skin of Michael Jordan there. Also cool to get a little more of a backstory from Steve Kerr, not knowing that his dad, being involved in Middle East studies, ended up moving to Beirut, which is the capital of Lebanon, and hearing the unfortunate events of how his father died. And I thought it was interesting how he and Michael Jordan never talked about that, because you look at kind of Phil Jackson and Dennis Rodman and how they're able to find that bond over their Native American artifacts and their times around Native Americans and how that really helped them get closer. You wonder if that would have helped Steve Kerr and MJ get a little bit closer. But then as that episode goes on, you realize how Steve Kerr started to earn the trust and respect of MJ through his play in the playoffs and hitting some of those big shots. It just kind of shows you that those two guys, because listening to Steve Kerr talk about how when his dad died, he really just got more and more invested into the game of basketball. It seems as though that was the best way for those two guys to really get, you know, on the same page and connect with each other, was through that game of basketball. So to see Steve Kerr talk about his family like that, talk about how he just threw himself into basketball, and then how through all of his hard work, he ended up earning MJ's respect in those playoffs. Just a really cool aspect of that story. And with Steve Kerr kind of being that one kind of guy in the background that you know is there during these games, we don't hear a lot from, getting to hear more from him was a lot of fun. So I loved the episode, obviously loved the whole series. I'll talk more about episode 10 tomorrow. Obviously with it being the grand finale of the series, it was just an amazing end to it. But talk about episode 10 tomorrow, but episode 9, like the whole series, just did not disappoint. But we're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll wrap up the day taking a look at some events that happened on this day in sports history. So stay tuned for that here on the Spencer Wilson Show on ESPN Radio 94.5 FM.
Is your technology infrastructure meeting the demands of your customers, your employees, you? How does your network scale to support your growth plans? With distribution hiding behind every corner, it's time you benefited from a network and security provider that will guide your organization through rapid technology change. Blackfoot, here to enable what's next. Visit blackfoot.com/SDWAN to learn more.
Well, as we wrap up this Monday, which has now gotten a whole lot nicer outside, at least over here by the station anyway, let's take a look at some events that happened on this day in sports history, going all the way back to 1897, when Bill Joyce, at the time playing for the American baseball team, the New York Giants, sets a record of 4 triples in 1 game. You think about how often you see triples nowadays. Not too often. So to get 4 in 1 game, that's pretty crazy. On this day in 1912, the A's beat the Tigers 24-2 as the Tigers use amateur players protesting Ty Cobb's suspension. 24-2. That's pretty amazing. On this day in 1929, the Dodgers beat the Phillies 20-16 and then lost 8-6 in the second game for a record total of 50 runs between the two. On this day in 1956, Mickey Mantle hits a home run from both sides of the plate for the record third time in his career. Also on this day in 1968, Al Kaline, who you've heard our pal Saxman Rick talk about on the show before, hits his 307th home run, surpassing Hank Greenberg as a Tiger. And then on this day in, I just had it. Where did it go? Here we go. On this day in 1982, Tigers outfielder Larry Herndon is the 14th batter to hit 4 consecutive home runs in baseball history. On this day in 1990, Edmonton winger Jari Kurri sets record for scoring in a Stanley Cup Finals game with 3 goals and 2 assists in a 7-2 win at the Boston Garden. And then finally, on this day in 2004, Arizona Diamondbacks' Randy Johnson becomes the 16th pitcher to throw a perfect game in the Diamondbacks' 2-0 win versus Atlanta. That game happening in Atlanta, too, by the way. But that is the show. Thank you so much for tuning in. Hope you enjoyed it. Hope you enjoyed The Last Dance as well. We'll talk about episode 10 tomorrow. Don't forget, we'll have a shortened show tomorrow with a special edition of The Coach's Show coming up tomorrow at 2:30. So be ready for that as well. But I'll talk to you tomorrow at 2. Enjoy the rest of your Monday. Peace.